Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth. Welcome to another episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Nir Eyal, the author of Hooked and Indistractable. And yeah, you just had like a really interesting career. You've written some really brilliant books that I've found really useful for both my business on making better technology in like an ethical way that actually gets people to have better habits, but also for myself running my business to be more indistractable and actually get the stuff done I'm supposed to be doing. So firstly, thank you so much for really benefiting my life and then the rest of the company that I run.
I appreciate that. Thank you. That's like catnip for authors. We love hearing that our work actually makes a difference in somebody's life. So thanks for saying that.
Cool. I've been getting your book for like as Christmas presents for people and had some good reviews already. So good work. And then, yeah, I just thought I'd let you give a short like 2 minute introduction to yourself, like what got you to end up writing the books and like where you're going next would be really nice to hear.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm what you call a behavioral designer. So I help companies design the kind of products and services that people use because they want to, not because they have to. And we can use the same kind of techniques that companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp and Slack all use. We can take those secrets to help people build healthy habits in their lives. And so that's what my first book was all about, was about how can we use these same techniques that are used to build these kind of products that we all use every day that we form habits around to build healthy habits. And that's exactly what's happened in the, what is it now, 7 years since Hooked was published. Companies in every conceivable industry, from education to healthcare, language learning, they all use, or many companies in these industries, they use the techniques described in the book Hooked to help people get hooked to healthy habits in their lives. Now, the flip side, right, the other side of the coin, is that sometimes we use a product so much that it can become a distraction. And so that's what the subject matter of my second book was, that being an industry insider and understanding every trick in the book, because I wrote the book, I can give an insider perspective into how to hack back these technologies and distractions many people find take them off track. So I love technology. It's wonderful, but it's imperative that we learn how to use these technologies in a way that serves us as opposed to us serving them.
Yeah, I really like the way your books have outlined that nothing is inherently kind of good or bad or like evil as long as it's sort of done correctly. And like, it's really useful to be forming habits for people to actually get them to do like the useful behaviors that will impact their life in a beneficial way. And that's how useful it was to kind of have both sides of the argument and things and like benefits there are to like Hooked. And like, it's not just like a negative, as in the actual sounding of the book does sound a bit like bad in terms of like hooking users and stuff. And certainly there's the whole like social dilemma side of things and people complaining around the way like social media is hooking us and other technology.
And to that point, sorry to interject, but there was a very conscious reason that the book is not called How to Build Addictive Products. There's a big difference between an addiction and a habit. An addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. Whereas a habit, we have good habits as well as bad habits. So habits are neutral. It's about which habits we decide to integrate into our life. And I would argue that technology has an amazing opportunity to improve people's lives by forming healthy habits. So the idea behind Hooked was not to serve the social media companies. They've known these techniques for years. My idea was to democratize those techniques so the rest of us can use them. So, you know, companies like Kahoot in the education space is a company that uses the Hook model to get kids hooked in classroom learning. Companies like Fitbod uses the Hook model to get people hooked to exercising in the gym. I mean, the examples go on and on. And to be fair, I was actually interviewed for the Social Dilemma movie, and I appreciate it. I mean, I will give credit to the film that it increases awareness of the potential misuse of social media. But my big beef with the film, and the reason they didn't include my interview, they interviewed me for over 3 hours for that movie, and they didn't include anything I had to say because I essentially gave them the antidote. I gave them the social solution to the social dilemma, and they didn't include any of it. And the reason they didn't include any of it is because it doesn't fit with the narrative. That the narrative is that we're powerless, right? If you don't have this base idea that these companies are controlling you. I mean, if you've seen the movie, they act like people are voodoo dolls and you can literally do whatever you want to them. And the characters in the movie talk about how they're hijacking your brain. brain. I mean, this relates so much to what you do, the kind of work you do around mindset, is that, you know, we know that the way you think about your ability, your locus of control, directly impacts what you will do. And so this is why I have such a big beef with the film and this greater narrative that you hear today, that we're somehow powerless and we're addicted and there's nothing we can do about it. That is exactly what the social media companies want you to believe. They want you to believe there's no way you could quit. Why even try? You're addicted. And that's why it's so harmful and why we have to fight against that narrative.
I like the movie that it sort of really made a lot of people more aware of like the problems that they hadn't realized they had. But yeah, I definitely didn't agree with the narrative that like we're completely powerless to do anything about it, or it was very one-sided with the whole sort of just how terrible everything was. And it was a bit frustrating kind of watching it and feeling like it wasn't really like a balanced argument and sort of slightly over-sensationalized.
A couple of weeks ago, there was a new study that correlated mental health symptoms with time spent online and the perception of time spent online. And what they found was that there was no correlation between how much time people spent on social media and other technologies and mental health issues, but there was a correlation between mental health issues and their perception of how much time they spent online. And people's perception of how much time they spent online was not correlated with how much time they actually spent online. So what this tells us is that if you have this mindset, again, back to mindset, I mean, this is so relevant to what you do. If you believe, oh, it's hijacking my brain and it's bad for me and it's evil and I need to quit and I can't, you're essentially creating this, what we call a nocebo effect, the opposite of placebo. You're creating many of these issues because you're ruminating on how bad it is and all this stuff that makes you feel out of control. And we know that agency, the sense of control, is critical for mental health and well-being. And so when you take that away and you feel like you're out of control, even when you are not, that turns out to be the real source of the problem. And so what we need to do is to empower ourselves to feel like we are in control, because we absolutely are. Tell me, how can Mark Zuckerberg reach into your phone and turn off those notifications, right? He can't. If you turn them off, he cannot turn them back on. You have the power to do that kind of stuff. And that's simple. That's kindergarten stuff. But the fact that they didn't even talk about that in the movie, right? Turn off your goddamn notifications. They're not constantly buzzing and beeping 24 hours a day. Anybody can do that, right? You don't need to buy my book to tell you that. This is common sense. And of course, we can all do that. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more we can do to become indistractable.
Yes. And they kind of present the only option is basically just deleting all social media, and like, which most people aren't going to do. Whereas actually presenting a bunch of reasonable arguments of how to like hack back some of your life and do stuff in your own power would be sensible.
They say that at the end of the movie, during the credits, the only solution is, yeah, you should just delete social media. Well, like, can you imagine going through this pandemic without social media? Like, as if it wasn't bad enough already, like not having the social connection. And this is the thing that the movie completely leaves out, is that all the benefits of social media, it turns out that there are massive mental health benefits to using social media if you use it in a particular way, you know, particularly with groups that are disaffected, groups that are have trouble connecting. You know, we know that there's been a 25% drop in the United States, at least, in LGBTQ youth committing acts of suicide attempts, has dropped 25%. Part of that is because of the miracle of technology connecting people who otherwise could not connect over in the real world, connecting them online. There's a lot going on that's very, very positive. So to tell people we'll just stop using it, it's not realistic. And frankly, it's not healthy either. I mean, for many people, it is their lifeline to social support.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I guess, back to the mindsets thing, when you have the mindsets of like not comparing yourself to what else you see on things and sort of just being happy for people that are having fun with their lives or sharing useful content and stuff, then like, it's not a bad place to be. Whereas if you're sort of looking at all the wrong things and have the wrong ideologies in your head, then like, it can be a bit more toxic. But back to the mindsets of how you use it. And I think one quote that like, I really like is the whole, with great power comes great responsibility, but with great responsibility comes great power, which is, it should be like ran down like the heads of all people using social media, but and like all the social media companies as well on both sides. Is sort of, if everyone was a bit more like responsible, we'd all have like a much better time using the things, which is why I like
That's a critical insight. We know that comparing ourselves to others and pointing out our deficiencies is never healthy. And it's not healthy in any medium, right? It's not healthy to covet our neighbor's possessions in any form. That's an age-old insight. And whether it's on TV or whether it's in magazines or newspapers or on the radio, it's not a new phenomenon that people covet what other people have. And we know that that's not good for our mental health. And if we do it on social media, it's also not healthy. But again, it's not the medium. It's what we're looking at, what we're consuming on that medium. That is something that we can change.
I think we're very aligned, and we could sort of get quite caught up with being very angry about all the same things. So also, it would be great to talk about some of the things, but I don't want to just say the exact stuff that's in your books exactly, because like people should just go buy the books. But I mean, I guess maybe if you have like your one favorite thing that you want to say from Indistractable that maybe would be useful for people just as a bit of a taster, and then we could go on to like some other deeper things around like your own personal mindsets.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm happy to tell you everything I know in the short amount of time we have. There's way more than we could ever cover anyway. So I'll give you all the good stuff because it's all good stuff. I'll back up and say, I wrote the book for me. Right? That I became an expert on habits and distraction and attention because I needed it more than anyone. You know, I used to be clinically obese. I found myself very distracted in my personal life. When I was with my daughter, I would find myself checking my phone as opposed to being fully present. I would get to work and every day I would say, okay, I'm going to work on that big project. I'm going to finish that big assignment. And yet somehow I'd start checking the news, checking email, Slack channels, doing everything but the thing I said I was going to do. And it was when I realized, wait a minute, you know, this is the skill of the century. If there's one superpower, you talked about the great powers and great responsibility. If there's one superpower I would want, it's just the power to follow through. I mean, imagine how amazing our lives would be if we simply did what we said we were going to do. Because the problem today is not that we don't know what to do. We all basically know what to do, right? Maybe in generations past, you could say, oh, how do you lose weight? I don't know. Does anybody not know that you have to eat right and exercise? We know that. Does anybody think that to have good relationships, we don't have to be fully present with people? Of course we do. Does anybody not know that to be better at your job, you have to do the work, especially the hard stuff that other people don't want to do? We know this. What we don't know is why we don't do the things we know we should. So the real problem is not that we don't know how to do things. I mean, if you don't know it, Google it. It's all out there. What we don't know how to do is to stop getting in our own way. And that's the problem of distraction, is why do we act against our better interests? And in fact, this is not a problem that originated with Facebook and the iPhone. Plato, the philosopher, talked about this 2,500 years ago. He called it akrasia in the Greek, which means to do things against our better judgment. It's not a new problem. It is part of the human condition to act against our better judgment, to get distracted. So I think the most important lesson that people can take away is a fundamental understanding of what is distraction, because it's such a mortal enemy of becoming the kind of people we want to become. So it's really important to understand what it is. And the best way to understand what it is, it's one of these terms that everybody thinks they know what it is, but at least, you know, personally, I didn't really understand it, because if you ask people what is the opposite of distraction, right, we will say it's focus, but that's not true. The opposite of distraction is not focus. If you look at the origin of the word, the opposite of distraction is traction. That both traction and distraction come from the same Latin root, right, which means to pull. And they both end in the same six letters, A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action. So traction, by definition, is any action that pulls you towards what you say you're going to do, things that you do with intent, things that move you towards your values and help you become the kind of person you want to become. Now, the opposite of traction is distraction. Distraction is any action that pulls you further away from what you plan to do, further away from your values and becoming the kind of person you want to become. So why do I say all this? Okay, so this isn't just semantics. It's very important, because I would argue any action can be traction or distraction. Let me give an example. When I would sit at my desk every day at work and say, okay, I'm going to get started on that big project. I'm not going to get distracted. Here I go. Nothing's going to get in my way. I'm not going to procrastinate. But first, you know what? I should just check email real quick. Let me do that thing on my to-do list that I've been putting off. The things that feel like I'm being productive, right? I would trick myself, right? How many of us have done this? That the thing we say we're going to do, we justify not doing it by saying, oh, I got to do all this other stuff too. Well, let me just get to that first, right? The thing on my to-do list, the email, that's work-related. I'm being productive, aren't I? No, because you have allowed distraction to trick you into prioritizing the urgent and the easy tasks at the expense of the important work. And so anything can be a distraction, even if it's work-related. Now, just as anything can become a distraction, anything can be traction. So I do not subscribe to this ridiculous chicken little narrative that, oh, social media and technology is melting our brains and it's addicting everyone and it's hijacking our minds. Rubbish. Silly. There is nothing wrong with playing video games. There's nothing wrong with scrolling social media. Somebody tell me why watching the boob tube, watching a football match on TV mindlessly is somehow morally superior to scrolling on a social media account. I can't tell the difference. There's no difference. Anything you do with intent, anything that is done according to your values and your schedule is great. Enjoy, play video games, watch a movie, go on social media. I'm not going to tell you not to, but do it on your schedule and according to your values. So you can turn distraction into traction by making time for it, by simply deciding in advance. The difference between traction and distraction is one word, forethought. So the time you plan to waste is not wasted time. So I'm not one of these people who say, oh, go on a digital detox, digital minimalism. No. Do whatever is according to your values. Whatever it is you want to do with your time in your life, I'm going to help you do. That's the essence of becoming indistractable.
That was amazing. It's just great to see how passionate you are about this. And yeah, you know, like some people like write books and things that they think they can sell something and you're like, but you're just like living and breathing this. And you're just so like, yeah, to see that energy coming out of you, like how much you just want to like help people's lives. That was lovely. Yeah. Honored to hear it. Yeah.
Well, I really did write it for me and I live it every day. I'm 42 years old. And as I mentioned, I used to be clinically obese. This is the best shape I've been in my life. I have a 6-pack at 42 for the first time ever. I'm just telling you this, like, because my life has changed in every conceivable way. I have a better relationship with my daughter, with my wife. I'm more productive at work. It's incredible. Like, this is the macro skill that affects everything else you want to do with your life, is this ability to simply follow through. And it turns out that it's not about doing the right stuff. It actually doesn't really matter what you do. It's about whether you do it, because if you do it, you can learn from it. What most people do is they say, oh, someday I'm going to do this. Someday I'm going to do that. They have this million item list of to-dos. They don't actually do it. So it's just one distraction to the next to the next. If you can fight that, then you really can self-actualize. You really can be the kind of person you want to be and live the kind of life you deserve.
Personally, I did like this 10-day meditation Vipassana retreat, and I remember being on it just thinking like how absurd it is that like anyone can literally write out what they should have eaten for the last 3 years to be healthy right now, kind of thing. And like everyone knows exactly what they're doing, and you're like, well, why can't I just sort of like in the moment actually choose to do the thing that I know I should be doing? Like, what happens to my stupid consciousness that it can't actually control itself? And yeah, ever since then I have been a lot more purposeful with my habits and like a little bit sort of distance from like my sort of experiencing self, I guess, which I thought was really useful. And I guess you didn't talk about meditation too much, but do you find that was like a really useful thing? Or also I wanted to ask was, what was like the thing that suddenly hit you with like, okay, I have to stop this? Was there something like a specific moment where you're like, okay, I'm just going to start like on this project of like hacking myself to be indistractable? Or was it like a slow, oh, I decided to start losing a bit of weight, I found that this thing helped me and maybe it could help me with other things? So just like the story behind how that happened would be nice.
Yeah, so for me, it was really a seminal moment. So after I wrote Hooked, a few months after it was published, I was with my daughter one afternoon. We had a beautiful day planned together, just, you know, some quality daddy-daughter time. And I remember we had this book of activities. One of the activities was, you know, make an origami crane. And another was a Sudoku puzzle. And one of the activities was to ask each other this question of, if you could have any superpower, what superpower would you want? And I remember that question verbatim. But when my daughter answered, I can't tell you what she said. Because in that moment, for whatever reason, I thought it was a good time to check my phone. And I started getting distracted with God knows what. And by the time I looked up from my device, my daughter was gone. She left the room to play with some toy outside. And I realized I blew this perfect daddy-daughter moment. And so that's when I kind of had to reassess my own relationship with distraction, that I knew that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to send her this message that whatever was on my phone was more important than she was. And yet somehow I got distracted. I did something that I did not plan to do, and she suffered the consequence. And so that's when I decided I had to understand this. I had to understand this deeper psychology. And so I did what I think a lot of people do. I went on a digital detox. I got rid of the phone. I got myself a flip phone from Alibaba for $12 that doesn't have any apps. It only sends text messages and receives phone calls. And I thought, okay, great. No more apps, no more social media. That's it. That'll solve my problems. And then I got rid of my laptop too. And I got a word processor from the 1990s with no internet connection. The technology is the problem. I'm going to get rid of the technology. And I still got distracted. right? Because I would sit at my desk and I'd say, okay, now I'm going to really work. I'm going to focus. I'm going to concentrate. I'm not going to procrastinate. But there's that book on the bookshelf that I've been meaning to look into. I need to do some research on that book. Or boy, my desk is really not tidy. Let me just clean it up real quick. Or the trash really needs to be taken out. And I would keep getting distracted. Because distraction isn't just about the thing that distracts you. It's about what's going on inside of you. And that was, I think, a big revelation to me was it's not just about the external triggers. The external triggers are the pings, the dings, the rings, the things in our outside environment that can lead us towards traction or distraction. Turns out that's about only 10% of the reason why we get distracted. 10% of the time you're distracted because of some kind of external cue, an external trigger. 90% of the time, it's not the external trigger. It's the internal triggers. What are internal triggers? Internal triggers are uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape from. Boredom, loneliness, fatigue, uncertainty, stress, anxiety. These uncomfortable sensations that we look for escape from. How do we escape them? We turn on the TV, we check our phone, we take a drink, we do all kinds of things to get out of our heads, to get out of these uncomfortable emotional states. So therefore, if we don't tackle this first, this is the first step to becoming indistractable, is realizing that time management requires pain management. If you don't have tools in your toolkit to deal with that emotional discomfort, you will always get distracted by one thing or another. Because we are looking for escape, procrastination, and distraction. It's not a character flaw. There's nothing wrong with you. You don't have some kind of diagnosis. It's simply that we don't have the learned tactics to deal with that emotional discomfort in a healthy way that leads us to traction rather than distraction. So that's step number one, is mastering the internal triggers. Step number two is to make time for traction. The vast majority of people out there have no idea what they got distracted from. Right? If I asked you, okay, what did you get distracted from today? What was on your schedule? Most people don't keep a schedule. Well, you cannot complain that you got distracted from stuff if you didn't know what you got distracted from. You must plan your day, including the fun stuff. If you want time for video games, do it. Enjoy it. Go on social media. But again, make that time on your schedule. And I show you exactly how to do that, how to synchronize with your boss, how to synchronize with your spouse. I show you exactly how to do that as well. The third step is to hack back those external triggers. And so I show you how we can hack back, how we are not defenseless, how we are not hopeless. We can remove all of those external triggers that don't serve us, whether it's on email, meetings, Slack notifications, the news, our kids. All of these things can be sources of distraction of the external triggers, and we can hack back every single one. And then finally, the last step is to prevent distraction with pacts. Pacts are when we use what's called a pre-commitment device. This research is decades old, and I show you exactly how to make these commitments so that when distraction rears its ugly head, you have a last line of defense. You have a firewall so that worst case scenario, you are prevented from getting distracted. So to answer your question, you know, what's the secret formula? It's that there is no one magic bullet. You have to use all four techniques in concert. Master the internal triggers, make time for traction, hack back external triggers, and prevent distraction with PACs. If you use these four techniques in concert, you can't fail.
Nice. Yeah, thanks so much.
How much money are you paying in interest on your credit cards every month? Probably too much. Then why not consolidate your credit cards into one payment at a lower fixed rate and start saving money? It's easy with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Rates start at just 5.95% APR with autopay and excellent credit. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no extra fees, and Lightstream just believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Just for Growth Mindset listeners, you can apply now to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/growthmindset. That's LIGHTSTREAM, lightstream.com/growthmindset. Disclaimer: subject to credit approval, rates range from 5.95% APR to 19.99% APR and include 0.5% autopay discount. Lowest rate requires excellent credit. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/growthmindset for further details.
Yeah, I guess just to be annoying, I'll go back to the meditation side of things because that was a brilliant, but I'll add something first because when I did the 10-day retreat, so when I normally try to do meditation like 10, 20 minutes, like it wasn't so much pain, it was more just being aware how useless I was at meditating. But when I did the retreat, you sort of do the whole try and sit still for like 2 hours and it's the most painful thing of my life. But you learn that like pain leaves, and you can kind of just like identify that there is a pain and not like let it overcome you. And you get this like insane sort of, yeah, like more painful, like, I mean, I've smashed my femur, which was apparently more painful than childbirth, but like the pain that I had on Vipassana was worse. You just sit there without moving, being like, it will go, my leg won't fall off, it'll be okay, I'll just like move on with my life after this thing, and sort of just sort of try and like hold your thoughts just on the breath and stuff. And it kind of gets you to really identify that like you don't need to react to pains, whether it's like an emotional or like a physical one. And so whenever those things come up in your life, whether like it's sort of like an emotion of like anger or something, or like I need to go to the fridge to get something to eat, it's like, okay, yes, you get to sort of sit and you get like that sort of the window of like consciousness of like, okay, see, what is this pain for? Do I need to sort of let it power me, or can I sort of make my choice first? So yeah, that's where I guess it really helped me, is like giving me a bit more of that power, as you said, around dealing with emotional discomfort. So
no doubt about it. I mean, there is a beautiful revelation that I think you found for yourself, in that feeling bad is not necessarily bad. And this is my big beef with the self-help industry, is that we're constantly fed this diet of aspiring to be happy all the time. How can that be a bad thing? Don't we all want to be happy? Well, we have to face the fact that we are not evolved to be happy, right? Happiness is meant through natural selection to be a fleeting sensation. Our default human condition is dissatisfaction. And that's a good thing. You know why? Because dissatisfaction and discomfort is what drives us forward. Think about it from an evolutionary standpoint. If there was ever a tribe of Homo sapiens who sat around and said, oh, everything's perfect, I'm so happy, everything's contented, our ancestors killed and ate them, right? Like, that would not have been a good evolutionary trait. You want a species to always strive for more. And that it is that disquietude that makes us make, you know, life-saving medicine and go to the moon and overturn despots. That dissatisfaction can actually be a very healthy and helpful sensation, as long as we use it, we harness it like rocket fuel towards traction, rather than trying to escape it or numb it with distraction. So that's a very, very important revelation that I had over the past few years, is that feeling bad is not bad. It's about what you do with that sensation, and knowing that you can't overcome it, that it's not going to destroy you, that feeling a little bit bored from time to time is fine, that feeling a little bit hungry is okay, that feeling anxious or lonely or stressed, it's human, it's all right. And I think that's what Vipassana shows folks, is, you know, it's very similar to what psychedelics have been shown to show folks, a new mindset, a new potential reality. Now, I think there's a lot of good that can be done with meditation. I will give one note of hesitation, and I don't talk about meditation in the book at all, not because it doesn't work, but because I feel like it's been covered to death. I feel like so many people have written about it in much more eloquent ways than I could. So here's what I'll say. Number one, it doesn't work for everyone. Many people get really stressed out with meditation. It does not work for everyone. That's been shown that for many people, it actually backfires. It just doesn't work for them. That's point number one. And so if it doesn't work for you, you're probably looking for alternatives. Even if it does work for you, and you alluded to this a little bit, that the kind of meditation that most people do, you know, sit with your eyes closed for 10 minutes and bring a mindful awareness to your breath, it has been shown to be very effective at making you a better meditator. It does not necessarily translate to other areas of your life. And you alluded to this as much. It's kind of like those brain training apps. You know, a few years ago, there were this craze of apps that can make you smarter. Well, they got sued and they lost in court because they didn't make you smarter. They made you better at taking these quizzes on the brain training apps. And in some ways, that's what we find with meditation. It does make you a better meditator, and it does open your mind to realize that you can breathe through discomfort. You can bring mindfulness to that experience, but we can't meditate all of our problems away. There is a time and a place to use different tools for different jobs. And meditation is wonderful for certain jobs, but it's not the end all be all. And so what I wanted to offer were other tools for folks when it comes to this problem of distraction. Absolutely, the first step is to master the internal triggers. And there are certainly techniques that we can use from mindfulness. I talk about techniques from cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, that we can absolutely use in our day-to-day lives. But there is a lot more that we can do as well. And so I wanted to share those techniques and those strategies.
Yeah, definitely. As in, I'll also go on the train of like the problems of meditation. It can almost be like a sort of a detachment from like reality and escapism, of where you actually sort of like avoid all your problems and be like, oh, it's fine, I'm just gonna go to my own internal world and then like ignore everything.
It's so true. And look, if you intended to get your work done, or to be with your kids or to do whatever it is you plan to do, and you just can't take it, you got to go meditate. Guess what? The meditation was the distraction, right? If you are not being intentful, if you're not acting with intent, and that becomes your escape. And let me tell you, if you spend much time in the self-help community, you will meet these people who are pathologically addicted to otherwise healthy behavior, right? We all know that person who runs compulsively. They're not running to something, they're running from something. We know the person who is a workaholic, right? We admire people who work hard. You can overdo that. If it crowds out other areas of your life that are important to you, you can become a workaholic. And the same goes for self-help and meditation. There are people who will compulsively read self-help, jumping from one guru to the next, and not actually implement anything they say, because that becomes a distraction from having to actually do the painful hard work of changing your life.
It's really annoying how you can kind of just get distracted by like reading more self-help things. And like, I annoy myself by the amount of new books that I read and not like going back to the books that I read that was really good and probably life-changing if I spent a bit more time making better notes and sort of actually tracking like each thing that was in it that was really useful. And delighted to be able to run a podcast or actually get to talk to the authors, and that suddenly brings home things a lot more clearly when you actually get the person tell you directly. But I've certainly been trying to, well, this has led to what my current business is, which is called Syncify. And it lets you, currently you can listen to podcasts at the same time as your friends or share the experience like with a day or two apart, but like actually talk about what you learned from that lesson. So as in like, you know, your podcast where you've got all the sort of probably most of the lessons that you've got in your books there, you can kind of then like actually listen to that with someone else and then actually kind of hold yourself accountable because someone else actually knows what you're thinking about, what you want to change. And then like, we'll be able to do it with audiobooks as well soon. And I've just found that's really useful for me over the last year, actually sharing all my lessons that I learned from books by myself with other people, just because by myself, it's harder to like take the action forwards. But when there's other people around, it's been really useful. So that's, I found quite good. But you didn't talk a lot about using other people in your books around as like an environment cue to make you do things. As in, do you feel like you've utilized others as well to make sure you stick to habits?
Yeah, so there is the fifth step about making pacts and preventing distraction with these pre-commitment devices. And so we can actually use these pacts with other people. I talk about three types of pacts. We have price pacts, effort pacts, and identity pacts. And this can be very, very powerful to kind of enlist other people that having other people. So for example, an effort pact is when there's some bit of work, some effort involved with getting distracted. So for example, in my household, a few years ago, while I was writing this book and still struggling with distraction, I hadn't figured out all the four pieces that eventually went into the book. I found that night after night, my wife and I were going to bed later and later. So we weren't getting enough sleep. Our sex life suffered. We've been married for almost 20 years now. And I came across this technique of using what I call an effort pact. And what we did, we went to the hardware store and we bought a $5 outlet timer. And whatever you plug into this outlet timer will turn on or off at whatever time you set. So in my household, every night at 10 p.m., our internet router shuts off. And so what I've done is made an effort pact, because if I wanted to turn it on, I could. Of course, I could, you know, go under my desk. I could unplug it, replug it in. But that requires work. That requires effort, right? My wife's also going to see me turning it back on. And so that's kind of this social bond of, wait, what are you doing here? And so it allows for this moment of mindfulness of, wait a minute, is this really what I need to be doing right now? Is this actually what I intend to do? Or do I need to start, you know, getting ready for bed and spending some time with my wife and actually, you know, getting enough sleep and rest? Because we all know how important that is. And so that would be an example of an effort pact. A price pact is when you have some kind of monetary disincentive for getting distracted. And that's also something you can use the help of others. And then finally, an identity pact. And this is the most powerful of the three types of pacts. An identity pact looks at the research around religion and the psychology of identity, that we know that when someone has a moniker that they use to describe themselves, it can relieve them from having to spend a lot of willpower and self-control because it's part of who they are. So for example, a vegetarian doesn't wake up in the morning and say, should I have a bacon sandwich for breakfast? It's not who they are. And that's why the book is called Indistractable. This is your moniker. Whether you read the book or not, you've learned enough here to start calling yourself Indistractable. You are the kind of person who strives to do what they say they're going to do. And the good news is we've been here before, okay, with a much more addictive and dangerous substance, cigarettes. So I grew up in the 1980s. And I remember in my household, this is going to sound crazy. If you were born after like 1985, this is going to sound completely nuts. But believe me, I remember that in my household growing up, we had ashtrays in our living room. My parents didn't smoke, but everybody had ashtrays in their home. Everybody had ashtrays. Why? Because back then in the mid 80s, you could walk into anybody's home and just expect to be able to light up a cigarette in their living room. And nobody would question this. They would bring you an ashtray. Feel free to smoke. Can you imagine if someone came to your house and lit up a cigarette in your living room? No way, right? You would kick them out. Well, what changed? Was there a law that says you can't smoke in someone's private residence? No, there's never been such a law. What changed was we inoculated ourselves with what we call social antibodies. We built up this resistance that certain behaviors are not acceptable. So when my mom threw away the ashtrays in our house, and when someone came over and just lit up in our living room, she turned to them and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. We are non-smokers. If you'd like to smoke, if you'd kindly go outside. But that's not who we are. We are non-smokers." That's exactly what we have to do with becoming indistractable, right? You know, "I'm sorry, I don't answer every text message in 30 seconds. I don't answer every email in 2 minutes. I'm not constantly on social media. And you know what? If you have lunch or dinner with me and you're using your device, not acceptable. You're going to have to go somewhere else if you want to use your phone, if you want to have a meal with me." Why? Because I am indistractable. It is who I am. And why is that any different than someone who wears unusual religious garb or has an unusual diet? We make accommodations for them, don't we? And we should do the exact same for this new identity of becoming indistractable.
It really relates into your whole mission. That's where you get so passionate. And I definitely would love to see a world in 10 years time where it's just completely wrong to like do things. And certainly, you know, some people are being more mindful around, okay, not having their phone at the dinner table and these kind of things. But it's just, there's so much of an urge and culture around like, okay, getting back to your email straight away and all these things. That's just, it all.
I feel like that was cigarettes too. I mean, you would smoke anywhere you want, whenever you want. And then people started saying, "Wait a minute, this isn't so healthy. Like, this isn't so good for us." Right. And so we started taking steps, and that's a much more addictive substance than cell phones. This is just a behavior, right? Like, we can change it. Right. And I tell you exactly how to do that. What do you do if a friend's using their cell phone across the table while you're having lunch? How do you call them out without losing your friendship? Right. There's a right way and a wrong way to do that. And so what I want to do is to help people take a stand and to make sure that we can start spreading these social antibodies so that we can still use these devices, but use them in a way that serves us as opposed to us serving them.
100%. That's amazing. I love that idea. I'm definitely going to try and make more content around that, I think. I was also thinking about, okay, it's a general ideology of like, okay, maybe you could start trying to apply that to like vegetarianism and stuff. And like, there's a whole movement around trying to make more people do that, those things. And your example of like, I've been toying between like vegan to just like, maybe I'll eat chicken sometimes kind of thing. And it's really hard when you're at like the level where you're not classed as something, because like you can't really stick to the thing. Whereas if you sort of define yourself as vegetarian or define yourself as indistractable, you can like really identify with the things a lot more and sort of be like, "Hey, I definitely just can't do this." So I really like that identity pact. Do you like talk to people a lot around how to like just make this a conversation with others?
Yeah. So half the book is about things you can do yourself. So that's where the four parts that we talked about earlier around mastering internal triggers, making time for attraction, hacking back external triggers, and preventing distraction with PACs. Those four steps, that's what you can do right now. You don't have to wait for anybody. You don't have to wait for the government to pass any laws. You don't have to wait for the social media companies to do anything. You can do this today. The other half of the book is about different social contexts, that we know that behavior is greatly affected by what other people do around you. So the second half of the book is about, well, how do we raise indistractable kids? How do we have an indistractable workplace? And how do we have indistractable relationships? So the whole second half of the book is exactly about these interactions with other people who may or may not be indistractable themselves. The best thing you can do, especially if you're a parent, is, you know, kids are born with these hypocrisy detection devices. They all come equipped with these little antenna that are looking for when we are hypocrites as parents. And so, you know, I see this all the time, parents saying, "Oh, my kid's always on video games. My kid's always on Facebook." And meanwhile, they're checking email constantly, right? We have to set that example ourselves and show our children, our coworkers, our colleagues, what it means to be indistractable. That's certainly the first step. But there's a lot that we can do after we've done that to help others and help ourselves through in these social contexts.
I remember I did an interview with Nicholas Wheeler, who's the founder of Charles Tuitt Shirts. And he was on his phone like the whole time during the interview. But like, at one point, he was also sort of complaining about like social media and like phones and like his kids being on phones the whole time. And he's constantly telling them to get off their bloody phones. But then he's like, "But I'm on my bloody phone the whole time and doing email and doing important stuff." And it is really hard, especially like, we always have like, okay, for our own reason, there's something, because you're on your own screen where there's something important for you. And you're like, "Well, this is a reason that I should be doing it." But then like, you look at others and you sort of judge them and you kind of don't have the self-awareness for your own things. It's really annoying.
I think it's hard when we don't know what to do. It's still kind of a new field, but how do I do this exactly, right? There hasn't been a guidebook for actually telling you what to do. And so that's what I wanted to write, because digital detoxes don't work. It's like a fad diet, right? You can't just stop eating certain things, you know? So like no fat, no carbs, like that stuff never works. It's temporary. What you need is a long-term solution. And so what I wanted to give people was, okay, here are the steps. 1, 2, 3, 4. Anyone can do this. Anyone can do it if you try. The only people who can't do it, again, back to mindset, are the people who don't believe they can do it.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I would, not to like have an argument, I would say that certainly when I like, if I fast for a few days and don't eat, like I do find it does make you aware of the fact that, like, you know, you don't need to be like following up on your hunger pangs like at every sort of given hour just because you're probably bored. And it does make you aware of where the pains are coming from and that maybe they're not what you think they are. So like not having a device around something for like as a detox does maybe make you a bit more aware, but usually you just go back to all your old habits unless you sort of have created something. But what I wanted to ask about was, let's say in 10 years time, we've created an indistractable religion and like the world is sort of just on point and doing their things. What would you do next? What would be your next mission?
Oh, I'm sure I'll find something else. You know, I always write my books to solve my own problems. Research is me search. And so I've got plenty of other things to think about and things that I want to do to improve my own life and to improve the world. So my timeline is about every 5 years, I write a book, but it comes to me after, you know, years of blogging. So I blog at nearandfar.com. I blog nirandfar.com, where I publish articles at least twice a month about whatever I'm working on. And then what tends to happen is that these topics congeal into subject matter. And then that becomes my next book typically. So I'm sure there'll be lots of things for me to write about in the future. But for now, that's kind of my day-to-day is researching, writing.
Okay. Not to distract you from the current thing. Classic problem. So true to being on Indistractable. Nice work. Okay. Well, thank you so much for the time. And yeah, great to have you. Thanks so much for being on the podcast and sharing all your amazing wisdom and helping me, myself, and all of the listeners on being a bit more indistractable.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure and an honor. And yeah, I appreciate it. Stay strong and stay indistractable.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.